guys and gals. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik. I hope you're doing well today. Thank you for stopping by RedEyesCreations.com, RedEyesMembers.com, or any of the other channels out there that picks up our radio feed. You can hear new programs three times per week. And in addition, we also feature a lot of news, videos, and a lot of other productions on the websites as well. We have a lot going on this month, lots of new interesting programs. And then at the end of this month, we'll be at the Secret Space Program Conference in San Mateo. I'm going to be hosting the event as well. And today we're going to talk about this main topic with Joseph P. Farrell, who joins us, one of the speakers at the event. Joseph P. Farrell has a Bachelor's of Arts in Biblical Studies and Philosophy, a Master's of Arts in History and Theological Studies, and a PhD in Patristics. He is the author of many, many fascinating books in the field of alternative research. And two of the more recent authored books is Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations and Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, with a focus, of course, on the black budgets and the connection to the off-world secret space program. And we're going to dive deep into this topic today. Fascinating stuff coming up with Dr. Farrell. So stay with us. And welcome back, Joseph. Thanks for coming on the program again. It's great to talk with you again. Hope you're doing well.
Yes, thanks for having me back on, Henrik.
You bet, you bet. So we have about, from the time we're recording this, about 21 days left until the Secret Space Program Conference in San Mateo. And I'm really looking forward to this one very much. I think we have a lot of interesting things that's going to come out of this because of the, well, we do have some cohesion in terms of the guests and the speakers, but also some differences there from, you know, different angles and different points of view. So I think it would be really interesting and some good Q&A sessions as well with the audience. What are some of the things you're going to address during the this particular conference, Joseph?
Well, I have two presentations. I don't know why they did it that way, but
you just have so much to talk about, that's why.
Well, I don't know, I hope so. The first one I'm calling Bullion, Brains, and Bonds, and what I want to do in that is kind of review the outline that I've made in some of my books and some of my blogs about this hidden system of finance, how that was put into place after World War II and kept hidden. And people really need to understand this and how it impacts on this idea of a secret space program, because my reasoning is basically that after World War II, the Western establishment, America in particular, were confronted not only with the long-term strategic problem of the communist bloc, but in addition to this, you know, there was the rebuilding of Europe that was necessary, and the biggest problem, and here I think Richard Dolan is once again just hit the nail right on the head. The biggest problem that they had in terms of a national security issue, which is really a planetary security issue, was the UFO. And to deal with this, I've been arguing that they had to, by the nature of the case, make some sort of response, and they had to achieve some sort of technological parity, or at least begin to develop it with some of the performance characteristics of UFOs. Now, to do that, they had to have what I've been calling a Mega Manhattan Project-style project, and this project would have, by the nature of the case, had to have lasted much longer than just the American participation in World War II. You know, the Manhattan Project was 3.5 years old by the time that they built the atom bomb. This would require something on the order of decades, and it would require, again, by the nature of the case, and kind of extrapolating from their experience from the Manhattan Project, would have required just an enormous amount of money. And on top of all of that, they have to keep all of this development extremely secret. So in order to accomplish all of this, the other part of the secret space program hypothesis that I don't think has been given enough play, other than perhaps in Catherine Austin Fitz's analysis, is this idea of finance. Are they going to finance all this? And I came to the conclusion that, all right, if we're going to have a secret technological development that's spanning decades, quite literally, we're going to have an entirely secret system of finance. In other words, a hidden tier of finance that very few people know about even exists. And I've come to the conclusion, and I outline this in my presentation, that, and to kind of spill the beans here a bit, I come to the conclusion that part of this mechanism had to have consisted of a lot of the Axis plunder that became available to the West at the end of World War II. But in order to access this, they had to make certain deals with the remnants of that post-war Axis elite, not only in Europe, but in Japan. That's the other huge part of the story. And that this loot, particularly in the Japanese case, was based on their literally, I mean, you talk about a well-organized, well-oiled operation in Asia to literally suck out every last ounce of bullion, gems, liquid cash assets, you know, just every conceivable thing you can think of. The Japanese did it, and this was an operation called Operation Golden Lily. It was organized under Prince Chichibu of the imperial family. And, you know, the secrecy of this operation was enormous, and American intelligence learned about this at the end of World War II, right at the close of World War II. And the fellow that learned about this, I'm going to be talking about this, and I've talked about it in some of my books, the fellow that organized this intelligence operation was Captain Ed Lansdale, who, if you know anything about American assassination, Kennedy assassination research, this is a major figure in most people's assessments of what went on in Dallas in 1963.
Yeah.
And Lansdale found out about this loot, that a lot of it had been cached in the Philippine Islands on Luzon and some other places in the Philippine archipelago. And he then flew to Tokyo to debrief General MacArthur. And MacArthur then told him, well, I want you to go brief President Truman on this. So Lansdale flies all the way from Tokyo to Washington to brief President Truman. And this is the part of the story that's very important. President Truman took the decision in 1947. There's that crucial year again. You know, we've got Roswell, we've got the establishment of the NSA and the CIA, we've got all of the UFO flap that year besides Roswell. So it's a very significant year, and President Truman took the decision to keep all of this top secret. So in other words, the American recovery of all of this Axis loot, both in Europe and Japan, was kept top secret, and that means something very significant that plays into our story. That means that the American national security apparatus quite literally is put into the business of international banking and clearing, and in order to manage all of this. And by the nature of the case, that requires the participation of certain major prime banks as well, because, you know, they're going to have to interface at some point with the public system of finance. So in other words, we're looking at a huge structure here, Henrik, and it's one that, and I'm four square in agreement with Catherine Fitz, who's also going to be speaking at this conference. She has pointed out many times, if you don't factor this into your thinking about financial analysis and so on, under the law, you're committing a material omission. Because it's a huge part of the story. You cannot predict the behavior of markets or anything accurately if you don't understand that they're going to be manipulated for the purposes of this vast secret project and how to fund it. So this is a huge part of the story. So that's what I'm going to be talking about in the first presentation. In the second one, what I attempt to do is kind of give a high overview of an attempt to reverse engineer the policy-making culture of that breakaway group, of that secret space program. And I call that UFOs, I don't remember the exact title of that second presentation, UFOs and the Tower of Babel moment of history or some such thing. Because I think strategically, the national security establishment is going to be looking at UFOs, not so much as an imminent threat, but at least as a potentially hostile threat. And I will outline in that second presentation certain UFO cases that would have immediately been of a national security interest to the intelligence establishment. The constant UFO activity over American and Russian nuclear bases, other hostile activity or activity that would be perceived that way, you know, UFOs diving at airliners and causing them to take evasive action and so on. Well, all of that's going to be perceived by that culture as a potential hostile threat and dealt with accordingly. And they're going, I think, inevitably, Hendrik, to come to the conclusion that humanity is in a dangerous period of history vis-a-vis this phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because there's a definite interest in human nuclear weapons and human capability. And I'm going to present a case there that the reason for this interest is going to spark an analysis of, well, you know, why is it that these things, wherever they're coming from, are so interested in nuclear weapons. And my analysis basically concludes that they're going to conclude that there's some aspect of nuclear physics that we don't understand that is of concern to these people. And then the question becomes, if so, what is it and why? Because we certainly, you know, if they're coming from anywhere in the solar system, we certainly don't have the capability in the 1950s and 1960s, either the Soviet Union or the United States or Britain or France, any of the nuclear powers, we don't have the ability to deliver these weapons off planet.
Right.
So that's gonna start a technological analysis, and I think it's also going to throw them into an analysis of UFO-like events that have been recorded throughout human history. So the other component is they're going to go back and do a historical analysis of texts and so on, and that's going to bring them to the conclusion, well, okay, we've seen this story before. It's the Tower of Babel. And, you know, the biblical version of the story has it that God comes down and scrambles the tongues of men. But there's a very interesting thing in the biblical story. There's no mention in the story that this is being done because human activity in this case is sinful or because of some sort of moral concern. The thing that's stated in the Bible is if they complete this, they'll be able to do whatsoever they imagine to do, and we better stop it.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So, you know, that kind of gives you the idea that whatever was going on back then, if there's any truth to the story, and I personally think there is, but whatever was going on back then, you know, we better stop it or we're in trouble. So, you know, that's going to provoke the idea, I think, in the national security establishment that we're on the cusp of some sort of technological breakthrough that is of concern to whoever's behind the UFO phenomenon, and we have to be very careful in how we respond, both in terms of our development of secret technologies and how we display it, because we don't want to have a preemptive intervention in human affairs, such as was recorded in ancient times and, you know, set us all back again several millennia. So I think all of these things are kind of factored in, and that's basically what I'm going to be talking about in that second presentation, just kind of reverse engineer, if I can, the policy-making culture and thought of these people. I think the inevitable consequence of that kind of analysis is that at some point the conclusion is going to be reached that just as a matter of planetary security, we have to weaponize outer space in some fashion. I think that's going to be an inevitable component. But I don't think, by the same token, they're going to think that we can afford to do it in any kind of provocative manner. I think by the same token, they're going to try and figure out some method or means of possible contact and ascertaining what motivation is. So it's kind of a complex thing that I'm trying to do in these presentations. I do have the second presentation is not simply going to be a review of what I've already published. I've got some new information that I'll be sharing in that second presentation. That's mm-hmm. rather interesting. It's just kind of a little tidbit I want to throw out there.
Well, very interesting. I think we should talk a little bit more about some of the points you brought up already and the division here. I think planetary security, this aspect is, of course, very interesting if we indeed kind of are faced with some kind of realization here that due to our development of certain technologies, we've already, they've gotten an interest in us because of this. And basically, yeah. if we move too fast or maybe even in the wrong direction, whatever, when we might not know what that is at this point, but if we move in the wrong direction, that might be a reasoning for why they would want to intervene in some way. Now, tell us first more about the nuclear technology, that this possibly is just not only a weapon threat, that this could be a threat itself as a weaponry to the UFOs and their civilization. There's something else going on around that. How do you reason around that?
Well, I've been laying out a case to be quite frank, ever since the very first book I did in this alternative field, The Giza Death Star. I've been laying out a case that I think that nuclear weapons, when they are detonated, and this is particularly true of the larger ones, hydrogen bombs or boosted fission bombs. In other words, we're talking about bombs that would be in the hundreds of kilotons and then on into actual fusion bombs with megatonnage. I think what happens when these bombs are detonated is that for a very brief moment, they function as transducers, given the geometry of the explosion. They function as transducers of energy from the structure of local space-time at that given moment. So in other words, it's my belief, and I've kind of argued this in various books, the most recent ones being The Nazi International and then Grid of the Gods, that depending on where on planet Earth you detonate the bomb and at what time, in other words, given planetary positions, phases of the moon, sun, and so on, that these yields that they get from bombs are going to vary slightly depending on the time and place of detonation because for that brief moment they are transducing the energy of the local vacuum or zero point energy or for whatever you wish to call it. And I came to that conclusion because if you go back and look at the very earliest American hydrogen bomb detonations, I'm thinking of the Mike test in 1952 and then on into the so-called Castle series of detonations, Castle Bravo, Castle Coon, those two in particular. And the interesting thing when you research these is that in the case of Castle Bravo, their pre-detonation calculations for the yield of the device told them that they were going to get about 5 to 7 megatons. When they fired the thing off, Henrik, they the bomb ran away. And, whoops. talk about a major whoops. The bomb ran away to 15 or 16 megatons, somewhere in that range. So in other words, they got a yield that was about twice what they were expecting. And, this really was, at that time in history, this was the major international incident, because, of course, that meant that radiation fallout was much wider and more dispersed and deadlier than they had anticipated. Now, the explanation that we're given for this is that when they constructed this device, they only included lithium six, you know, they had lithium deuteride as the fuel, and it was the lithium six that they were thinking was part of the fusion reaction. But there was a great deal of lithium seven in this lithium deuteride sample, and they weren't calculating that in their thinking. In other words, they didn't think that lithium seven would enter the fusion chain reaction. That's the explanation. Well, the explanation is nonsense, Henrik, because, as I pointed out in the Nazi International, fully a year prior to this, we had that crazy so-called Nazi scientist and swindler in Montebank, Dr. Carl Richter, down in Argentina, who very boldly told the Argentinian authorities that he was using lithium-7 in his reaction. So in other words, he knew, and the Argentinian physicists who interviewed him knew, that lithium-7 was part of, you know, ordinary thermonuclear chemistry. So in other words, I think they are hiding something here with the Castle Bravo test, and that the yield ran away, certainly due to the lithium-7 factor, but there is another factor involved, I think, because, you know, this was at least thermonuclear chemistry that was known to a so-called Nazi swindler in Montebank. And the other bomb that was part of the Castle series that I think is significant is Castle Coon. This was a thermonuclear device that had been designed by none other than Edward Teller and his team at Lawrence Livermore. And again, they had calculated a pre-detonation yield that was going to be in the megatonnage range. When they fired this thing off, it fizzled. It didn't even achieve a megaton of yield. It was only in the kiloton range. So in other words, the test was a failure. And again, I find the official explanations that it was a poorly designed bomb and so on and so forth to be kind of nonsense, because, you know, it was Teller that designed the American hydrogen bombs that period. So, you know, it's not as if he and his team don't know how to do this. So again, why does this thing fizzle? Now the interesting thing that I point out in the covert Wars series of books is that, unknown to most people, the Castle tests were concerned, security was concerned, with the possible presence of UFOs during the test.
Right.
And there is a certain body of evidence to suggest that both at Castle Bravo and Castle Coon, there were UFOs present in the area. So, again, we have an indicator of something's going on here in terms of nuclear physics that we don't know. Now, to make the long story short, what I suspect is going on is this. When a nuclear bomb is detonated, I suspect that it sends out a longitudinal pulse, a longitudinal wave of compression and rarefaction within the physical medium itself. All right. In other words, it sends out, if I can put it bluntly and crudely, it sends out a gravity wave.
Right.
And as a result of this, if it's a gravity wave, any large mass becomes a natural resonator of the wave. And that means longitudinal pulses, as far as I've been able to determine when you examine the physics literature, most of the papers that I've read suggest that longitudinal pulses of that nature travel faster than the velocity of light. So in other words, if you have the capability of measuring or recording such a longitudinal pulse, and let's assume UFO, whoever's behind them, does, then they're going to say, uh-oh, look what just happened on that planet. We better go check it out.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, if you keep firing these things off and they keep showing up, the inevitable conclusion of the national security establishment is, whoa, there's a physics here we don't know about. We better investigate. And interestingly enough, just to kind of put a little icing on this cake for you, Henrik, there's a picture that appeared on Google Earth a couple of years ago, about 2.5-3 years ago, and I actually blogged about this on my website a couple of years ago, of a tetrahedral pyramid. Okay. There's no other way to describe this, folks, of a tetrahedral pyramid structure that is built inside of the Nevada test ranges in this country.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, so, okay, what is the pyramid doing inside of the Nevada test ranges? And, you know, what are they doing with this thing? And my suspicion is that they're using it as a waveguide precisely to measure some of these longitudinal pulse effects from nuclear detonations. So, you know, I think they began to investigate nuclear bombs from that point of view. And since we're talking about gravity, longitudinal pulses, you know, nuclear bombs as transducers of the energy of local space time when they're detonated, let's go to the Soviet Union. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because if you go to the Soviet Union, who do you have there that's saying there's something wrong with our nuclear physics? Well, you've got Dr. Nikolai Kozarev, all right? Famous, world famous astrophysicist. And what's he been saying? He's been saying that there's something wrong with our model of the sun as a big, huge, chained up hydrogen bomb. Because it's not putting out energy, it's not spitting out energy within the predicted values from relativistic understandings of stars as big chained up hydrogen bombs. They're producing a lot more energy from somewhere, and what he started to think was, okay, they're transducing energy from the fabric of local space-time. And interestingly enough, then, once Kozarev comes out and speculates with this in the 1950s, he's denounced in Pravda, okay,
right.
And, you know, and he shuffled off the stage of science, in Soviet science, and, you know, people think, well, okay, he's committed some sort of scientific heresy and he's a crank. What actually happened, we found out after the fall of the Soviet Union, was that when he started making these speculations, his work was immediately classified at an extremely high level, and he was then, for the next 20 to 30 years, investigating through various experiments all of this idea of torsion field effects and their relationship to nuclear energy. That's exactly what he was doing. So my suspicion there is that, you know, the Soviets found the same thing when they were detonating their bombs. You know, they had their pre-calculation yields, and the bombs were either running away and going far beyond those calculations, or, like Castle Coon, for whatever reason, they were fizzling and not achieving the predicted yield. And they set about to investigate these things. I suspect very strongly that when the Soviet Union detonated its big Tsar Bomba, you know, that massive hydrogen bomb that had a 57 to 67 megaton yield.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they detonated this thing up at Novaya Zemlya, up toward the Arctic Circle, and I think that the selection of that site was very deliberate. I think they were trying to investigate some of these local space-time planetary effects with that bomb. So, you know, I think some sort of process of reasoning like this, Henrik, was behind the national security apparatus's examination of why is it that UFOs are so interested in our nuclear weapons. And it's because, to get to the point here, it's because nuclear processes are a gateway to much larger capabilities.
Right.
And yeah. I think that's the concern that whoever's behind the UFOs had, and I think that became apparent to our national security apparatus and certainly the Russian national security apparatus during the thermonuclear age.
Now, so many interesting things here that we could discuss more. Do you think that there were any along the way here then? I mean, we have a Cold War beginning to ramp up here. I mean, after this point, after the Second World War, not maybe immediately, but pretty darn fast there. Do you think that they began to, at some point, working together, you know, crossing the boundaries of the, you know, of the U.S. and the USSR, and that they realized, okay, we have to work together here at some point, right?
Well, I think that, I think that's a great observation. In fact, you know, one of your own countrymen was a very well-known physicist, Nobel laureate physicist, that was investigating similar areas, and that was Hannes Alfvén.
Yeah. Definitely.
You know, he did very kind of secretive research for the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in plasmas, and I recount some of that in my book Cosmic War. Alfvén was one of these physicists like Kozarev that was not satisfied with the conventional wisdom regarding thermonuclear reactions and processes and plasmas and so on, and he investigated it rather thoroughly. And if memory serves me, Henrik, Alfvén was one of these scientists that maintained very close contact with people both inside of the Soviet Union and in this country as well, Anthony Peratt and some other people that were also involved in plasma research. And the reason I'm singling Alfvén out here in response to your question is that my suspicion has always been that there was some sort of coordinated activity or investigation on, you know, cooperation at a very secretive high level between the Western Bloc and the Soviet Bloc. And I strongly suspect that it was brokered in part, at least, by people like Alfvén, you know, being from a neutral power that was kind of midway between the two blocks.
Right, yeah.
I've strongly suspected that it was brokered in part by people like that on the one hand, and on the other hand, as I kind of argued in SS Brotherhood of the Bell, I think it was also perhaps coordinated by the penetration by the post-war surviving Nazi apparatus, and particularly by General Galen's organization, because again, you had an apparatus there that had deep penetration inside of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Bloc on the one hand, and had a very deep penetration and working relationship, obviously, with American intelligence and America's national security establishment. So I strongly suspect that there is some such coordination, and that we have to look at indicators, you know, people like Alfvén, we have to look at indicators like organizations like Galen's that had a presence, a heavy presence, both inside of the Soviet bloc and inside of the West. We have to look there. I suspect also that people like Dr. Jacques Vallée, who's maintained very cordial relations with scientists inside of Russia, are also perhaps, you know, I'm not trying to point fingers, but I think perhaps they're kind of a network of loose informal relationships like that we have to look at as well.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So very interesting. We might have here then a kind of a, obviously, justification for a secret space program along the way. The divisions that we think about when we contemplate the end of the World War, even considering what you've been talking about in terms of the Nazi network within, you know, that they were shipped out to different factions here, etc., that's something that fairly quickly in the process might actually begin to deteriorate, in other words, and we might have
I think that's part of the story too. You have really kind of a both and situation, Henrik. You've got a simultaneous deterioration of relationships and exchange of scientific information. One thing that interests me that is still not an area adequately explored by historians of science in the West is just exactly what was going on in the Soviet Union because there are indicators that Soviet science took a very different turn than Western science. For example, you know, you have that very secretive program that occurred in the Soviet Union investigating pyramids for, oh, a good 20 to 30 years. You know, they built those big pyramids just outside of Moscow and in other places in Russia, and they were studying these things very closely. And I suspect that in part that might be related to some of this nuclear program, because again, you've got that pyramidal tetrahedral structure apparently inside of the Nevada test facilities in this country, which and that, indicates...
By the way, I looked at that. I saw the post you did. I was searching for it as well. That looked like it's pretty much built up by desert material, earth. And it's an earthwork thing, right?
Yeah, it appears that way to me as well, Henrik.
Yeah.
You know, this is a large structure. I mean, it's a very large structure from what you can see from the picture. And, you know, I think that in part that may have been in response to the Soviet program. In other words, I think at some point American intelligence learned that the Soviets were doing these things and were thinking, well, you know, what are they up to? Why are they doing this? And at some point they made the connection with nuclear weapons, and hence they built this thing inside the Nevada test ranges. So something is going on in Soviet science. So there's clearly, as you said in your question, there's clearly some sort of break. The other thing that is an indicator that the Russians have as well been investigating these kinds of UFO-related technologies is there was a story that came out of Russia, and I blogged about it. I can't tell you exactly when. It was sometime earlier this year, about Russian research into Dr. Yevgeny Pakletnov's semiconductor research and his anti-gravity discoveries in respect to his semiconductor research, or pardon me, superconductor research. And there have been claims made that the Russians have actually been able to construct it sounds to me either like some sort of weapon based on the microwave soliton effect or some sort of gravity pulse generator, which is effective, they have said, to a distance of, I think, a kilometer. It may even be as much as 100 kilometers. I can't recall right off the top of my head. But the bottom line here is that there are indicators that, you know, the Russians have certainly kept up with that research that went on during the Soviet Union. And that, for me, is the signal important point here. Because the indicator is then that the Russians are as concerned as the Americans about planetary security, and we have to add to that, Henrik, in terms of this idea of the secret space program, we have to add the statements that Prime Minister Medvedev made about a month prior to the Chelyabinsk meteor incident. He came out and said that it was necessary and that Russia should build an asteroid defense system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I blogged about that as well. And you can go online and go to RT, Russia Today, and search for this article. The article appeared on Russia Today. And Medvedev outlined what he was calling for. He was calling for kind of a planetary dew line, you know, the old defense early warning system that was erected by America and Canada up in the Arctic Circle. Well, that's what he was calling for in terms of a detection system for nearby, you know, potentially threatening objects in space, being asteroids, and then a defense system to take them out. And if I recall correctly, he made in his remarks statements to the effect, well, there are a variety of ways that we could take these things out. You know, nuclear weapons would be one. And then he goes on to say, and other things. You know, something to the effect, you know, and something else, but we're not going to talk about that. And then he went on in his remarks to say, you know, well, this is something that Russia would like to cooperate with everybody else and do. But we're going to go ahead and do it anyway, whether or not we get any cooperation. So then a month later, of course, Chelyabinsk happens, and all the strange indicators that something may have exploded that meteor. And then more statements to the effect of needing some sort of planetary asteroid defense system coming out of Russia after that incident, and even more recently. So yeah, I think there is something going on internationally with all of this talk about asteroid defense. I think that that's a guise, a disguise, quite honestly, that they're concerned about something else in addition to asteroids. They just don't want, at this particular juncture, to talk about it. But, you know, for Medvedev to come out and say, well, you know, we're going to use nuclear weapons and other things. Well, you know, what other things?
Exactly. And this is the guy who, about a year before that, I think, as well, sat around with that open mic event and talked about this little book of his, right, with the... I still haven't been able to determine it. Was it all just a big joke? Is it kind of a crude Russian joke, or is it, you know, was it something to that? You know.
Well, you know, this good point, Henrik. I mean, I don't know, but let's throw something else into that context. Let's throw the recent statements of Pope Francis I into this.
Oh yeah.
You know, he's giving his homily somewhere in Rome, and all of a sudden decides to talk about baptizing Martians.
Yeah.
You know, well, I'm sorry, folks. You know, the Vatican is the oldest and most experienced political chancery in continuous operation on the face of the planet. And the Vatican doesn't say anything without a plan.
I agree. Yeah, exactly.
And you know, this idea that Francis was just kind of making a one-off joke here, no, that doesn't play in my book. What's interesting to me in Francis's remarks, you know, like Medvedev, he's kind of half joking and half serious.
Right.
But I think ultimately they're both being very serious. The interesting thing about Francis's remarks is that he's couching it in terms of something close by. In other words, his reference to Mars. He could have easily have said, you know, Alpha Centauri or the Pleiadian system or what have you. But no, he couches his remarks in terms of something close by, which I found very, very interesting. It's almost diametrically opposed to what we think we know about planetary conditions on our celestial neighbors in this solar system. Because certainly we've had no real good indicators that any of these planets are supporting life. There's debate about Mars, of course, and microbial life and so on.
Right, yeah.
And there's debate about some of the satellites of the gas giants and whether they might be supporting life. But certainly nothing conclusive that would indicate an intelligent presence, and yet there Francis comes out and says this.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, what is this about? I mean, half of me is like, oh my God, the Vatican is turning into like a weird Star Trek New Age cult. You know? And then the other part is like, okay, wait a minute. They're literally trying to, you know, begin and open up the dialogue about this because they know something mm-hmm. more, you know? So I can't decide.
Well, I'm kind of like you. I'm six of one, half dozen of the other, although I kind of lean to the idea that they know something. Because let's look at it very honestly, Henrik. The last 2 months, in terms of space news have been just downright bizarre. You know, not only the Pope, but you have NASA. And this I haven't even blogged about this yet. I just talked about this yesterday with George Ann Hughes on her show. NASA and MIT just made the announcement that they've been able to transmit without much noise entering the transmission. They've been able to transmit something like a 19 megabyte per second internet communication. And if I recall correctly, they did this to the moon. And I'm thinking, what?
Huh.
Yeah, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. In other words, the article is framed in terms of, you know, bringing internet to the moon. Well, why do we need to bring internet to the moon?
Right.
Is the hidden colony or base up there? Are they missing, you know, are they missing their Facebook game?
Exactly. Farmville, you know, got to get to the moon. Yeah.
Exactly. But the real point here is this is, you know, this is an indicator that they are serious about permanent human presence in outer space. That's really what it means.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm of the school, Henrik, as you probably know, that when these announcements are made in the public literature, they've probably already gone and done it and been doing it
sure.
for quite some time secretly.
Yeah.
And that raises again the question, all right, why do we need internet on the moon?
Is it a tactical chess game, meaning that if there is something else that needs to be done in terms of research, they need to put certain pieces of the puzzle in place, otherwise people will realize that something is off with the technology. That's got to be a hell of a tactical, you know, conundrum to keep your eye on, you know.
Well, I agree with you. I think that's definitely partly in play here. They're coming out with these bizarre announcements. You know, you can go on phys.org and look at all the things that are being done in terms of acoustic levitation and so on and so forth. And then you add some of the ideas in Dr. Paul LaViolette's book, Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion. You know, that book is just hugely full of detailed information and technologies that are out there that have been researched that are definitely in the exotic realm of propulsion ideas and have been for quite some time. And, you know, I pointed this out in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations, even the Brookings Report. You know, when we hear Brookings Report, the ufology community has kind of conditioned us to think of the Brookings Report in terms of its statements about, well, what do we do if we contact extraterrestrials or artifacts of some civilization out there? Well, we suppress the evidence, okay?
Right.
That's what everybody thinks of when they think of Brookings Report. What they don't think of is the other things, astonishing things that the Brookings Report said. One of them was in a certain passage that I cite in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations, this report comes out and says, well, there's all sorts of other long-term technologies that we need to look at and consider in terms of space, things like ion propulsion and fusion. And at one point, and this was a jaw-dropper for me, Henrik, it mentions something that it calls magnetohydrodynamic drive. And that's kind of a fancy way of saying anti-gravity or field propulsion or electrogravitics. And it also, when it mentions this, it goes on and says, work is already being done in this field and it's very promising.
Huh.
And say what?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And no further comments on it after that, you know?
No, wow. None. Zero. Zilch.
Yeah.
So in other words, you know, this is a document that's being prepared in the late 1950s. It comes out in the early 1960s. And here we are. We're already talking about methods of propulsion other than chemical rockets. And it comes right out and says, and the work is very promising. You know, so there's your indicator right there in the official NASA study that there's something else going on with space technology, and it's not these, you know, updated versions of 3,000-year-old Chinese rocket technology.
Right.
I think it's very clear that their tactical planning here, Henry, is, for the moment, it appears to me like they're going to keep up the rocket show. But in my bones, every indicator that I'm familiar with, you know, the things in LaViolette's book, the things that other researchers have found about these technologies, the mysterious, strange behavior of NASA with things like, you know, let's do internet connections to the moon and so on and so forth. All the indicator is that it appears to me that we're watching a carefully coordinated media campaign, social engineering, that I think is going to prepare us for a much different and bigger space presence over the next 50 to 100 years. I mean, you know, stop and think about it. When you've got Medvedev in Russia, the Pope, all these people making these strange, bizarre statements, and these little tidbits that NASA tosses us every now and then like that. And the other thing that really intrigues me, Henrik, that I also am planning to blog about, I have a blog scheduled about this, NASA has also just recently published an ebook. And in the ebook, it talks about ancient astronaut theory. Now, that to me was a jaw dropper because turn the clock back 30 years ago to the time that Chariots of the Gods, 30, 40 years ago, the time that Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods first came out. At the time, the theory was fringe. It wasn't something that you'd expect NASA ever, ever to talk about in an academic paper.
And it's not just that they're jumping on the bandwagon because of the due to the popularity of the subject and funding and those kinds of issues?
No. I'll tell you what I think it is. In the two Covert Wars books, I like I mentioned earlier, I argued that one of the things that the UFO phenomenon will inevitably force the secret space program, breakaway civilization, whatever you wish to call it, to go back and look at ancient texts and any medieval reports that could be considered to be some sort of UFO sighting event. And by the nature of the case, that means that as part of their secret policy-forming culture, they're going to be looking at what, in effect, is the ancient astronaut theory. And I suspect that when NASA released this, what it's done is it's told us that this is exactly what happened in secret. In other words, they're starting, in my opinion, to disclose.
Right, yeah.
They're bringing us into the picture. And this is being done very slowly. It's being coordinated. I think we're going to see much more of this type of story, but you have to, you know, you're going to have to watch for them. It's not going to be on Chris Matthews or Sean Hannity or any of these talking idiots on television in the near future, but it's starting.
Well, interesting. Let's pick this up here after a break, Joseph. Much more to discuss. I do want to give out some details here. Obviously, I would say the event of the year here for sure, the upcoming conference here. With, of course, Joseph P. Farrell, we have Catherine Austin Fitz, Carol Rosen, Richard Dolan, Michael Schrapp, Robert Morningstar, John Rappaport is going to be there as well, and also, of course, Mark McCandlish, and I'm going to be hosting the conference as well. So for tickets, folks, to join us here in San Mateo on June 28th and 29th, please go to the website secretspaceprogram.org, and I do hope that you'll join us there. It's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of good stuff is going to be given out there as well, so we're all very much looking forward to it, and of course we hope that we can see you and everyone there as well. Now let's give out some other details. Of course, feel free, Joseph, if there's something else you want to mention about the conference as well in specifics, but if not, give us the details to your website, give us some of the book titles, etc., where we know where to go to find more about you.
My website is www.GizaDeathStar.com. That's all one word, all lowercase. And on the website, I do have a web store that you can order my books. The books I've been talking about that detail some of these concerns are The Nazi International, Grid of the Gods, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, that's another important one, and then Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations. I kind of lay out what we've been talking about in those particular books.
Absolutely. Giza, Death Star, and of course, Joseph's books are cutting edge. There are some absolutely fascinating research and works within contained within the pages of all of these books. And it really is like a long series. And of course, people can read more about which books are connected with each other. But it's all connected. That's the bottom line here. It's all a long thesis that you've been working on now for how long is it? 10, 15 years?
I started, you know, this is kind of a surprise to me, Henrik. I really didn't start making this a full-time career until about 5 years ago, when it just barely became a full-time viability for me. But I started this strange series of, I don't know what you'd call it, alternative research or whatever, back in 2001 with my first book called The Giza Death Star. But at the time I wrote that book, I made up my mind. I had planned several other books to follow up on it in a particular order. And if the book did well, then I'd keep writing them, and it did, and so I did. All my books are related to each other, but you don't have to, you know, you don't have to read them in order. You can read them in any particular order, and they'll still fit with each other. It's been kind of a long, It's basically, all the books are basically chapters in a big, huge book. But, you know, if I sat down and written a 10,000-page book, no one would read it.
Nope. No, very good, very good. I also want to mention as well here before we end for the first segment that Red Eyes members can check out the discount that we have for you for the Secret Space Program conference as well. If you simply log in there and click on any of the banners from redeyesmembers.com, you can get to that page and get your discount coupon code there as well. So do check it out. But of course, then secretspaceprogram.org, that's the main website for the conference. Join us there. And also GizaDeathStar.com. Stay with us, Joseph. We'll be right back with more. We'll pick this up in the second hour with Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. As we continue, we discuss more on the Tower of Babel moment, as well as the strange geopolitical moves pertaining to issues of wars, mass surveillance and the NSA, corporate takeovers and move towards global world government and general chaos. The question is how these moves are tied into the secret space program. We discuss usage of nuclear weapons and the development of other energy harnessing technologies. We discuss the factions as they play into the scenario and the increase of funding and dedication into the private space sector and how that might alter the current trajectory of the field as well. A lot more coming up in the second hour with Joseph P. Farrell. Sign up at redicemembers.com. We have all the details on the members' website. It's quick and easy, just €5 per month. And we have a 3-month recurring or 3 months to 2 years non-recurring subscriptions available. We have a vast member section filled with interviews, research, investigations, theories and facts, controversy, and other very, very important subjects that you must know about in these times of manipulation, social engineering, political agendas, you know, everything you need to combat the mainstream indoctrination channels, the mouthpiece of the global elite. We do not have any commercial interruptions or website banners, and we are an intrepid, independent, investigative radio program that dares to go where we need to go to expose the hidden agendas, figure out what is going on, and analyze the important and interesting issues of our times. By the way, we have upcoming Richard Dolan for more on the breakaway civilization. We have Vahan Setyan to talk about unknown aspects of Armenian history and also the Armenian genocide, horrible event in human history. We'll also have Joseph Atville to discuss the typology of Shakespeare as a reversal of the Gospels, a document of revenge, the Shakespeare portfolios, that is. We'll also discuss who the real author was. We also have Felice Vinci and William Mullen on the Baltic origins of Homer's epic tales. Very interesting theory there. Also John Rappaport, David Matheson, Carol Rosen, and many more are coming on after that. RedIceMembers.com, sign up and stay tuned. We'll be right back with Hour 2 with Joseph P. Farrell. Thank you for listening.